What's the most you've ever lost on a coin toss? Hello and welcome to episode 138, even though you told me a few minutes ago, I've already forgotten, of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we relentlessly hunt down masterpieces previously described by other grizzled lawmen as such. Not lawmen, critics, same thing.
We've got grizzled lawmen as well, you know.
I am Nick, the... This time I'm going to be the implacable spirit of vengeance and murder of the podcast. And I'm joined as ever by Roger.
I just stumbled into this, so what's going on, man?
Bang. We are discussing another Coen Brothers film. I like them a lot. I think you like them mostly. Oh, certainly Fargo won the most, even if you haven't liked everything. We are discussing their possible masterpiece from, is it the 2007. Wow, okay. 2007, No Country for Old Men, based on the Cormac McCarthy novel.
Yeah.
Also No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, there isn't, I think, much in the way of actual dates in the thing, but it's strongly suggested that it's happening sometime in the 80s, for reasons we'll come back to.
All the cars look like they're from the 80s anyway, and no one's got a cell phone.
But the part of the US they're in is kind of a piece of shit, so...
Yes, it's we're in Texas. I think it's West Texas. I don't know my Texas very well.
It is clearly a poor part. That is well signalled.
It's a poor part of Texas where there's wide open plains a la Paris, Texas. And, of course,
and
Mexican drug dealers. I mean, we have once again, our sole representation of Mexican characters is drug cartels and drug dealers, which is...
But also mostly dead people.
And mostly dead people as well.
the thing that really struck me, and I know when we were watching A Simple Plan, I thought this felt like the sort of thing a Coen Brothers would do. This is the Coen Brothers doing A Simple Plan to some extent. I mean,
yes,
not in terms of the characters, obviously, but in terms of, okay, you know, a guy stumbles across a large cache of money, realizes that people are going to be coming looking for that money, and decides that he's going to have to take steps in order to benefit from it.
Yes, so this man in this case is Llewellyn. Played by Josh Brolin. Have we had Josh Brolin on Ribbon of Memes before?
I think so.
I can't remember him before.
The man is pretty much my age, and somehow I don't find him convincing when he tries to look rugged. This may be my problem.
I've seen him in other things. I liked him a lot here. We don't get a lot of backstory of who he is. He's just sort of out hunting, I think, and then he comes across this massive scene of devastation and death, and finds the money, finds one man still alive asking for water, takes the money, and is...
Doesn't have vaguely, any water.
It doesn't have any water, but is haunted by his conscience later in the night, and goes back to take the guy some water, which proves to be a bad idea.
I mean, step one, the guy's dead anyway, but...
Yeah, the guy's dead anyway. But we don't get lost. I mean, the impression is that he's a bit of a bum, you know, he doesn't seem to have a job or anything, but he's
living in a trailer, but so is everybody. Is it actually a house? It just looks like a trailer.
It's a house, it's just a house, that one of those houses that looks like it's about to fall down.
This was something of a career rebirth for Josh Brolin, because he'd been a child actor, known for the Goonies mostly.
Oh God, yes.
And he'd done a few things here and there, but this was basically his return to popular film.
Wow, so, yes. So, he went on to be Thanos in the Marvel films, and then other things since then.
But this also means there's basically no typecasting. The audience seeing it would not really have any cue as to, you know, okay, you know, this guy is played by Tom Cruise, he's going to be a hero or whatever. It's just, you know, this guy is played by Josh Brolin. We don't know who he is. We just got to work it out.
No, he's an interesting character because he's kind of, he's got movie star looks, but he's kind of nondescript. Is that fair to say, Josh Brolin? So you don't quite, he's one of those actors that you think, oh, I know him, but I don't quite, he's very good. Again, I'm being, but we don't, it's hard to get a handle on him. I suppose the point of him knowing all this survival stuff that he very quickly gets into is that he's probably been to Vietnam, like a lot of the other characters have.
I think it's explicit, yeah.
Yes, he may well say, when he's
talking to the border guard.
Oh, yes, yeah. Though he may have been bluffing, but it's pretty clear he's got some military or at least outdoor survival skills training or knowledge. So when he is pursued, he's certainly got some idea. He's not like a know-nothing bozo like most of the characters in Fargo. he clearly got some idea. He knows how to break a trail. He knows how to hide and survive in the wilderness, to dress a wound. So he's got some basic training. So he's our first principal character, and the first one, he's not the first one we come across, but he's the first one we sort of with. The second principal character is Tommy Lee Jones's grizzled old sheriff, Bell, Sheriff Bell.
Yeah, I don't think we've talked about him on Ribbon and Moves before either. I'm jolly impressed with him here. I had seen him in, frankly, one really terrible film and one actually okay, but he's not exactly being a master of acting. He's pretty good in Under Siege, but he's not playing a challenging role. I mean, his job is to chew the scenery.
Yes, he's quite a reliable scenery chewer. I don't dislike him, but I haven't been hugely struck by him. But here he's acting. Again,
the other one, I just want to mention this because I think we're never going to do this unless we decide to do every film Nick Cage has been in. This is a film with Nick Cage and Sean Young and Tommy Lee Jones. Sean Young shortly after Blade Runner. You would think it couldn't be bad.
What film is it?
It's called Firebirds or Wings of the Apache, depending on which market it's in. It's basically a Top Gun clone with helicopters.
Bad. Yes.
It's really very, very bad indeed.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah, there was a string of fast vehicle things after Top Gun, most of which Tom Cruise was in, as far as I remember. But that was the one that he wasn't in. Okay. Anyway. Well, that's a shame.
Having seen those two performances, I was not particularly expecting much, but I think he does a pretty good job. I mean, yes, all
he's
right. His face does a third of the acting for him by being that face.
He's supposed to look old and craggy, and he does. He's got a similar, similar role to Billy Bob Thornton in that he's playing a much more vulnerable character and a much more, well, here he's not even cynical. He's just kind of worn down and tired.
Arguably, he's becoming more cynical as time goes on. I mean, this is the story of, in effect, his lost investigation. So,
yes, yeah, he's going to retire after this,
and that I think is where the title comes in. You know, he is an old man. He was a good cop in the 60s and 70s, but now he just can't cope with this new sort of criminality.
Yes, I think the title, yes, I agree, that the title itself, I believe, comes from a Yeats poem, but I'm not good at poetry in general, and it's, I don't know, I read the poem and I wasn't particularly struck, but it's a line from a Yeats poem. We'll talk about it later, but this is where I start to just basically disagree with the premise of the film, but we'll come on to that later.
So anyway, that's threads one and two.
Then we have Javier Bardem.
Javier Bardem. Anton Chigurh, who is, well, basically he's the Terminator, except he enjoys it.
Yeah. He's the spirit of vengeance. He's one of those.
He's the unstoppable killer.
They crop up a bit in Coen Brother films, and in the Fargo TV show, that they're basically spirits of vengeance that, yeah, exactly as you say, can't be bargained with, can't be reasoned with, doesn't feel pity or remorse, and just is going to kill you.
And there's a suggestion, I think, in the first scene that maybe he's getting off on the killing as well, but
yeah, I think there is.
He would probably regard that as unprofessional, and the point of it is the killing. If you enjoy it, so much the better.
Yes, exactly. I think he wouldn't admit that he kind of gets off on it, but he does. He's also got one of the greatest haircuts to ever grace the screen. It's very disarming. Now, his weapon of choice, for some reason, is a captive bolt gun. And this is where Nick's murder corner, which is very rare, is going to come into it. A captive bolt gun is a device used for stunning cattle. And the way it works, it's basically a gun, but instead of a bullet, it shoots out as kind of a 3-inch metal pole.
I believe a lot of them do actually use blank ammunition as a propellant.
Yes, so you put it on the head of the creature, and it...
In the right place, this is quite important.
Well, the thing about a captive bolt gun is it is not a murder weapon, it's a stunner. The idea is to stun the animal, and then you immediately slaughter it while it's stunned. But the point is, if you just do that, it's not going to kill a good proportion of the animals you do it to. You'll put a hole in their head and a hole in their brain, but it's not like it destroys the brain stem. And crucially, with humans, their skull is not thick enough for that stun to have much of an impact. So it doesn't even...
So what you're effectively doing is carving a 3-inch channel into, well, minus thickness of skull, into the brain.
Yes.
Which is basically going to get your frontal lobes and maybe a bit of other stuff. But
there's people who try to commit suicide.
You might still be walking around at that point.
Yes.
There are industrial injuries of people who've lost much more brain than that and were still reliably those people.
It's not a very reliable murder weapon. It might well kill you, but there's a fair chance it wouldn't, unless he's going to pith them afterwards, which it's not.
Which, at the very least, we don't see.
No, so it struck me as a bit gimmicky, but also as a professional killer, I was thinking, well, that's a shit weapon to use. I mean, he does use it for other things, particularly like boring his way through locks, which seems to work.
Yeah, punching cheap locks out of doors—that's fair enough. I feel that particularly in the States, it would probably be a lot easier to get hold of one that used actual blank ammunition, then you don't have to carry the gas cylinder around with you.
Yeah, but certainly the ones I've handled are just guns. Basically, look just like guns. Mm. They don't have this weird gas. But then it wouldn't have the nice kind of visual effect of the slight squeak when he opens the thing because you know he's going to use it. So visually, you know, it's an interesting weapon, but it took me out of it a bit because I was like, that's a terrible weapon to kill people with.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I mean, all right, when we... I'm thinking of the original Terminator here, particularly, you know, where he is clearly the villain. Yeah. When we see him, he is basically... He is either being villainous or he is the self-repair in the bathroom, that kind of thing.
I hadn't thought of that, but that is basically a scene out of Terminator as well, isn't it?
I'm thinking specifically of Terminator. Which again tells us about what this creature is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I enjoy Terminator. I didn't find this grabbed me the same way, possibly because it's trying to say, yes, this is a human being, at the same time as it's saying he's an implacable instrument of murder.
I agree. I mean, he's a chilly. There are some scenes that really work for me with him. The one that always stands out to me whenever I think of No Country for Old Men is, the one in the gas station where he goes in and he just escalates it to the point of you're going to die on this coin toss, but it's never said. It's all done subtly. The slow dawning realization on the gas station attendant that actually this could end with his death, but it's never explicitly said, and he picks the right coin toss and Shigga just walks out of there. And then the guy is left just never know. Was I imagining that? What's happening? That was going. I think that's an incredible scene and that really works for me. But yes, a lot of this, I agree with you. It's trying to sort of have him as a character. I think frankly, it's just not a character I believe exists. And he doesn't convince me that it exists. You know, I don't think humans are like that.
the way I read him is the whole coin toss thing is this is an accommodation that he has found that allows him to sleep at night.
Yes, and I like the way he's called out on that because at the end we have Kelly MacDonald, who's sadly underused in this, but is really good as Llewellyn's wife. Is she wife or girlfriend? I think she's his wife, actually. And she basically calls him out and says, no, I'm not going to play your game. If you're going to kill me, that's on you. It's not on this coin. And then it's heavily implied that he does kill her anyway. Though we don't see it. You could choose to believe otherwise.
Well, we don't see a lot of the killings.
No.
That's one of the things I actually quite like about this.
Yes. Sort of.
I mean, it's doing its share of titillation by violence, but it doesn't go as far as it might, and perhaps that's a good thing.
Well, we recently talked about Assault on Precinct 13. Sorry to use the title you don't like, but we both really liked it, and that film is tension, 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 release. This film is, it's very disjointed in the way it, deliberately, I'm not saying they don't know what they're doing, they absolutely know. They're aware of the conventions of this genre, they're aware of like, this was after Simple Plan, wasn't it? Yeah, that was 99 or something. But they were advisors, I think, on that film, or at least they're friends of, Sam Raimi. They know exactly what they're doing, so, and I feel like there's an element where they're trying to introduce, oh, this is real life. This is just randomness. Just random things happen. And it's not all, it doesn't all follow narrative conventions and haha, which I agree. And I like films like that. But then I feel like it's trying to have its cake and eat it too. Eat its cake and have it too. I feel
that's the original version. Yes. Which makes a bit more sense of the, yeah.
I never hate like that expression. Yes. Cause you can chronologically have a cake and then eat it. But you can't eat a cake and still have it. So they're trying to eat their cake and still be in possession of the cake by one saying, "Oh, we're not following narrative conventions. This is we're just going to randomly kill off." Spoiler: Llewellyn gets killed off screen. You know, we followed him the whole time. We've had some lovely tense sequences before then, which I'd like to talk about as well. Yeah. But then we have this kind of extremely cinematic character of Anton Chigurh, who I wouldn't believe outside of a film. I mean, there may be people like that in reality, but I don't. I was more won over by a History of Violence kind of characters.
I think the thing that really irked me about this, and this is this is really a script thing more than a filming thing, because we'll come back and talk about the filming aspects, and I'm much more impressed there. But
yeah, that's fair.
A lot of story. The Terminator is a cliched story, you know, the unstoppable thing is coming for you, but you survive.
Yes.
And a lot of stories do that. It's a predictable twist.
Yes.
But it is still a twist. Assault on Precinct 13, the unstoppable horde is coming for you, but you make it through to the end of the night, because you're heroes. Yes. And this is the story about the unstoppable guys coming after you, and you don't survive.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, well, you know, nobody tells the story about the guy before David that Goliath fought.
Yes.
That's not an interesting story.
Well, it's not even clear to me who actually kills Llewellyn. So Chigurh goes and gets the guy, but it may even have been the Mexican cartel that kills Llewellyn. But either way,
that's what the Wikipedia synopsis says.
But it happens off screen and we don't know. Mm. We just know that Chigurh got there as well and got the money. And I'd forgive it. Well, okay, I haven't. So, first of all, I agree. The filmmaking is wonderful. I mean, they really know what they're doing, the Coens. Mm. They get, I think, fantastic performances out of everyone.
We've talked before about the American Southwest as a filming location and the freedom versus imprisonment and so on. And I think that they play very well on that here as well. And even if most of our locations are, you know, cheap motels, that's imprisonment if you want it.
Yes. So we have, yes, I agree that the kind of, we have a bit of open country and freedom. We have fantastic performance by Tommy Lee Jones, by, I think, Josh Brolin. Javier Bardem, despite me, you know, complaining about, well, we both feel the character's not really a real character, but I think he's fantastic as that. If he's got to play that character, he does a fantastic job of
it. It doesn't really stretch his acting wings, I feel, but he does it well, yeah.
Well, he's very good at projecting menace without being menacing particularly. A lot of that is the filmic setup as well. Woody Harrelson we have returning. Have we had Woody Harrelson before? We have. He was in Billboards, Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, where I liked him very much there. He's a much more kind of typical Woody Harrelson character here, I think.
This is his slaphead phase rather than his full head of hair phase.
Yes. But he's very good as, I think that one works better. You know, he's built up as this character you can trust, you can rely on. He's he's in it a bit, and then he gets murdered. But I think that works quite well.
Interesting because he is very much the same sort of role of that Ed Harris plays in A History of Violence, where he is the reasonable. He is clearly a bad guy. He is the guy who, in a normal film, would be the unstoppable menace coming after the hero, and then maybe they could, yeah, you could resolve that in some way. They might negotiate.
They'd have some banter, or at least try to.
They would be the, we have a grudging respect for each other, but I'm still going to kill you, that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah.
And in this, he essentially tossed aside in the face of the real unstoppable menace. And that does a good job of making the unstoppable menace look even more unstoppable. So, yeah.
Yes, I agree.
And I think that the key thing about Chigurh here is, you know, he's got this job, get the money back, and kill everybody who knows about it. And he is quite determined that he is going to do that job, even when his bosses are saying, don't bother, don't worry about it, you know, or we're sending our other guys. No, you give me this job, I'm going to do this job. I'm going to kill all your other guys who get in my way.
And you. I mean, it's a strange character, isn't it? Because he's not really got a sense of honour in the sense. He's very happy to betray anyone at all who gets in his way, including the people who asked him to do it in the first place.
Mm.
To the point where you're not really sure quite what his motivation is, because... Again, because he's not really a real human. He's just a spirit of vengeance and death. And that's his whole point in the film, to be this implacable spirit of vengeance.
The Terminator, he's presented as a human being as well, and I agree with you, that's where it doesn't quite fit together.
Well, you have scenes like, you know, Woody Harrelson's death scene, where he's just kind of trying to say to Chigurh, you know, what's wrong with you? I like that they're exploring it, but it feels to me a bit pointless exploring a psychology that I don't really believe is an actual... Maybe such people do exist, but I don't think in that... you know, there are certainly sociopaths and psychopaths. I feel it slightly veers into my dislike of all serial killers are geniuses trying to teach humanity a lesson. It's the kind of idea that if you are a sociopath and a psychopath, kind of gives you magic powers.
I've read a certain amount about serial killer studies in the real world, and if you got a really exceptionally unusually smart one, you might get somebody who's an interesting opponent for a group of police or detective heroes or whatever, but most of them are,
most of them are just kind of sordid and icky.
Improper relationships with their mothers, and
yeah.
It kind of all goes on from there, and nobody ever straightened them out. So,
yeah, exactly. So it's not that, but it leans into that kind of almost like idolization of murder that I'm a bit uncomfortable with.
Yeah, there is certainly some attempts to portray Chigurh as cool. I mean, you don't want to be him, clearly, but
yes, I'm
not entirely happy with that coolness as it's shown up here.
I prefer the Fargo style, oh shit, what have we done? well, we bollocked that up, didn't we? That was a mistake.
I thought you were just going to put off this policeman. Now we have a body.
Yes, exactly. That remains one of Ruben and me's favourite scenes, is the police scene in Fargo. Which just switched from comedy to tragedy and almost back again. This is a great scene. So on the film, I'm going to talk a bit more about my problems with the kind of, so that's one of my problems with the thought behind the film, is trying to mix kind of, oh, this is reality and randomness with real filmic cinematic characters. And
I haven't read the book. I'm told it hews fairly closely to the book.
Well,
I must admit, I've been more impressed with other Coen Brothers films where they've been working more of their own material.
Well, one of the things apparently they cut out of the book is a lot of Sheriff Bell's backstory, and the story is much more Sheriff Bell and him feeling old and here, I mean, he's almost sidelined in his own film, but I feel like that again, this is the film. So the film has this controversial ending. So even though he's got the money, he promised Llewellyn that he'd kill his wife. Llewellyn didn't do anything to stop that. And so even though Llewellyn's dead, he's got the money. There's no reason he goes and, presumably kills Llewellyn's wife.
I think it's strongly implied, yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of, I forgot what he kind of cleans his boots at the end, which is something he does after he's killed someone.
And then he gets into a random traffic accident and says to the kids who are trying to help him, "You never saw me." Well, okay, so.
Well, that's effectively where the film ends, really. It's just a random act of, I suppose, I don't know if the film's trying to say even someone as, like, Terminator-like as Sugar can be, you know, cast about by the random acts of fate. Okay, but the rest of the film hasn't. So I find that difficult because it's just, again, I feel like the cake is being kept despite its consummation. Here in that's a phrase.
Well, I imagine we both have a fair idea of what an Eastern cake looks like inside the bowels. So.
Well, I feel like the film is trying to say, oh, cast about on the winds of fate, it can happen to anyone. Except that the whole film has not been like that. It's been a tense cat and mouse game. And it really good at it, you know, the bits with the, where Josh Llewellyn wakes up, you know, he's lying in bed and he's thinking through, there is no way he could have found me. And it's a really nice scene where he basically, and he doesn't say any of this. I think he just says, there's just no way. And then he finds the tracker. Mm. And then we have the really tense scene. He realizes Chica's right outside. Those scenes are brilliant. The bit where he's fashioning, they're really good physical actors of creating a space. Like, what I mean by physical actors is, you know, the bit where he's, Llewellyn's really smart at hiding the money, and then he's got to find a way to get it, and we're getting
from the other tension. Room that he hadn't expected to have to get it from. And
Also, a
scene that really struck me is Sheriff Bell searching out a hotel room where he strongly suspects Sugar is hiding.
Yes, to the point where he kind of hallucinates Sugar, and that's the closest he comes in any situation to finding his prey, because his. Spoilers, his investigation is kind of pointless. Everyone ends up dead and the money doesn't come back. It's just a waste of time for Bell.
One has to assume that Sugar returns the money to not his boss because he's shot him, but maybe his boss.
Well, you don't know. I suppose the point that the film then... So then the film ends with sad Sheriff Bell going up to meet his old boss or something like that. Or his uncle.
So somebody he worked for back in the day, yeah.
Yeah. And they're basically just saying, oh, it's bad, isn't it? It's really sad. People die. And then it ends, it absolutely ends with him having these dreams.
And then his old boss says, yeah, but the same thing happened back in my day as well.
Well, I think that's my issue with it. So one, the film kind of closes on Sheriff Bell as if that's the narrative we've been following along. But honestly, his narrative has been sidelined throughout the whole film. Now, in the book, I think it makes more sense because Sheriff Bell has got much more backstory. We learn he's like guilt-ridden from what happened to his patrol, his platoon in World War II, I think. I haven't delved into it that much, but we get some more backstory. It's kind of the film kind of saying, well, this is a satisfying conclusion to the narrative because, you know, the story is really Sheriff Bell's all along. And if you thought differently, well, fuck you, because we're not going to tell you what happens to the other people. They just got signed. It's actually Sheriff Bell's story. And I feel that's a bit of a lie, really. Honestly, he's the narrative we're least interested in following. What we're interested in, what has created the most tension throughout this, apart from that really good scene you describe with Bell thinking Sugar's there, all the tension has been between Llewellyn and Sugar, both of whom are just sort of cast aside or forgotten about. And then we're like, oh, it was Bell's story all along. And there's an element of sort of chin stroking. Well, if you watch it again, I'll think you'll find it's Sheriff Bell's story. Well, I have watched it again and I still don't think it's Sheriff Bell's story. I think that is a bit of a confidence trick. It's how the book ends, but they changed it so... I just didn't buy it. It wasn't as satisfying. I'm all for ambiguous endings and abrupt endings, but I find it very unsatisfying and frustrating here.
Well, I'll say two things about the adaptation. I mean, one, I haven't read the book anyway, but two, a film that needs to stand on its own. It is no excuse for the film to say this is explained in the book. If the film doesn't explain it, then the film doesn't explain it.
Totally agree.
That said, all right, perhaps Sheriff Bell is a bit of a cliche, but Tommy Lee Jones does an excellent job of portraying him. I mean,
oh, yeah.
First time you see him, this man is tired.
Yes.
And, yeah, here is the exciting bit of the story where the feds say, do you want to come and have a look at the scene? And obviously the next thing is going to be cut into the scene of, nah.
Well, I
what's
like
it, what's it going to teach me?
Yeah, I've seen enough, thanks, it's fine. Yeah, I like, he's basically trying to avoid this investigation as much as possible. And when he does it, he's reluctant. And he probably would have got killed if he'd done better at it anyway. Mm. The central premise of the film seems to be, and it undercuts its own premise, I think, in a way, as you said, it seems to be, things are just getting worse. People are more violent. The kind of crimes we have nowadays, they're just...
Well, particularly 80s cocaine violence.
It's just beyond anything we've
seen. All of a sudden the bad guys have Uzis.
And I disagree with the premise, really. You know, if you actually... This isn't the Daily Mail where we have to put every knife murder on the front cover, you know. Actually, violent crime has been dropping steadily for a long time, even in Texas. But it doesn't make an interesting headline. The world is... I mean... Maybe 2024 is not the best example, because maybe the world is getting less safe.
Well, but as you say, there's a lot of knife crime in the headlines. There is no more knife crime than the last year. There is less knife crime than last year. But you wouldn't know it from the headlines, because clearly the headlines are coming up to, we must ban knives.
Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like it's following the premise of, oh, everything's worse and everyone knows it. And I'm like, well, no, statistically that's not true. There's fewer murders and... Maybe that's why it's set in the 80s.
Maybe for a policeman in remote West Texas, things are worse. Okay.
Well, maybe, but as you say, that's undercut by the guy going, yeah, well, it was just the same in my day, really. Mm. But it feels like if the whole story is Sheriff Bell's disillusionment and retirement, and really everything else is just window dressing to that, then why do we focus so much on the cat and mouse game, which Sheriff Bell is not in any way privy to, which ends, frankly, unsatisfyingly. I mean, we'd call this neo-noir, right? Would that be?
I guess.
But I like that they're trying different commands. And funnily, where it really worked for me is The Big Lebowski, because they're basically, this is a detective story where the main character does no detecting whatsoever. And it works for me because I found it funny. Here, this is a neo-noir film where everything you're set up to think will happen from your knowledge of films isn't going to happen.
From your knowledge of stories overall, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, from narrative structure. And that's fine, but it doesn't replace it with anything satisfying.
Mm.
Ultimately, I found it an unsatisfying narrative.
I think where I enjoyed it was where I was... not really paying attention to the script and the overall plot. Mm. It was the individual filmic moments, which the Coens have done before very well, and they do again very well here. It's just a shame they're not really strung together in a way that produces a satisfying story as well.
Yeah, it's almost like a picaresque of very tense scenes with a narrative that doesn't quite... Yeah, there's so many scenes I love here. As you say, Tommy Lee Jones' just tiredness in the cafe, in the thing. We have Llewellyn's desperate survival tactics, Woody Harrelson. All the individual bits of it are great. I like Anton Chigurh. I don't like, he's the one who got the standout, you are the best, you're going to do brilliantly. He got all the awards for this film. I think that's a bit unfair, because I think Tommy Lee Jones is phenomenal in it. Josh Brolin's pretty good. I agree with you that Javier Bardem, he doesn't really have to do anything other than look stony-faced. Now, he does it very well, and it's very scary. To do that gas station scene, that'll remain one of my favourite tension-building scenes. But just the character himself, I see a lot of those characters now, particularly in Coen-related films, these implacable killers. And I'll believe it if it's a cyber robot from the future. But
or a demon, you know, that also works.
Yeah, some supernatural thing. But
saying that this guy is supernaturally smart and durable and so on, and at the same time is in some way a normal human, doesn't quite work. I mean, he's not a very normal human. I mean, I don't think he has anything approximating a normal social interaction with anybody. So.
No. And there are people like that, but they're also not highly skilled, professional, merciless killers who seem to think a captive bolt gun's a great... all right. Anything more to say about No Country for Old Men?
I don't think so. I mean, I enjoyed it more in retrospect, thinking about the individual scenes than while I was watching it, working out what was going on. I don't think not a masterpiece for me. I'm obviously not going to argue with the Oscar voting committee because we'll be here all day. But I would not have awarded this film four Oscars and four more nominations.
I agree. There's parts of it that are absolutely masterfully done because the Coens are masters of their craft. The scenes that absolutely stand out to me. But I agree with you that a film has to stand on its own, and it's got to have some kind of satisfying narrative, or at least some reason to be unsatisfying. I don't think
well, we're back to Paris, Texas, aren't we?
Yes, yeah. I do. I enjoyed watching it again. I'd seen it before. I wanted to watch it again. And I didn't, this time I didn't have that what the fuck thing when the film ended, because I knew it was going to do that. But because of that, I was watching the whole way through to see if I'd missed. Anyway, I won't re-argue my case, but I agree with you. It's pieces of a masterpiece, but it doesn't quite put together as one.
I would just like to quote from Javier Bardem's Academy Award acceptance speech. Thank you to the Coens for being crazy enough to think I could do that and to put one of the most horrible haircuts in history on my head.